Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of New Books Network. I am your host, Lee Pierce, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric, and I'm very excited today to welcome Minna Salami, Sensuous Knowledge, A Black Feminist Approach for Everyone, which was recently published by HarperCollins. And of course, if you're not familiar with Minna, she is the creator of the hugely successful and popular Miss Afropolitan blog, and in this new book combines Black feminist thought with popular cultural criticism and personal reflection, as well as meditations on South African and African religion, in order to basically theorize an entire new way of imagining ourselves, our relationships to each other, and our connections to the world around us. It's a collection of essays that explores history, power, oppression, liberation. And at the center of all of this is this question of Black women, their relationship to autonomy and liberation, and the role of narratives to heal and empower. It offers fresh insights on key cultural issues that impacts women's lives, including power, beauty, and knowledge, and examines larger subjects like Afrofuturism, radical Black feminism, gender politics, and it provides a historical and cosmopolitan outlook that is really engaging. And Minna is an excellent writer, a terrific storyteller, and she touches on everything from Lauryn Hill, Beyoncé, Audre Lorde, Toni Morrison, all the way to Renaissance painters. It's really, it's absolutely fascinating read. And I can't thank Minna enough for joining us, and I hope that you enjoy the episode. And with that, I'm very excited to welcome Minna to the New Books Network. Minna, are you there?
I'm here. I'm very excited and honored to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and where are you calling in from, by the way?
I'm in London, in the United Kingdom.
You are in London currently. Okay.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Well, tell us about yourself. Tell the listeners a little bit about you and maybe what brought you to write Sensuous Knowledge before we start digging into what has definitely been my favorite read of the last couple months. I had said my favorite book that I'd read this year was Shayla Lawson's This Is Major, but I've now decided that your book and that book are tied for my favorite book that I've read this year. So
thank you so much. I need to look up Shayla Lawson's book. Haven't heard of that.
Have you not read Shayla Lawson's This Is Major?
No, I haven't, but I love that title. It sounds great. I'm instantly curious. What is it that
this
is major?
Major on, I think it's on Diana Ross, Black Girls and Being Dope. Ooh, I think is what it's called. Yeah.
I have completely missed that, but I've instantly written it down.
You should. But let's focus on you for now and we'll worry about Shayla Lawson.
Yeah, thanks for the tip. And thank you so much for those kind words. I'm really delighted that you enjoyed my book so much. My name is Minna Salami, and I am the author of Sensuous Knowledge, which I'll be talking about more with you. I'm also the founder of a blog called Ms. Afropolitan, which I have been authoring for over a decade now. And the themes on that blog is in my book, Sensuous Knowledge. So it's a blog about the intersections of feminism with popular culture, with philosophy and African studies and a range of other topics. I am predominantly a writer, but I also do some lecturing, and I'm a feminist theorist by training. and a researcher. And yeah, that's me in a nutshell. I've recently been really interested in the connection between, how should I put it, between the material and the abstract, I could say. So between desire and bodies, knowledge and images, and then some of the themes that already manifested in my book, Sensuous Knowledge. So the intersection between the political and the aesthetic. And anyway, we'll get into that. But images and symbols, connecting that sort of with theory and matter, is something that's a preoccupation of mine at the moment, I would say.
Yeah. And that's, I think, especially for this particular podcast channel, a conversation I definitely want to have. Before we dive into that, though, first of all, I want to say, I remember actually when Miss Afropolitan came out, because I was starting grad school, mid-grad, it's like 2010, right? So yeah, I was early grad school, and blogging was like the new thing in higher education. Right? Oh, we're going to just have everybody blog because that's what all the students want to do now. And I didn't know anything about blogging. And so I remember asking around, like, what, there's some good blogs that are, you know, kind of like academic, but also popular and the sort of thing that the students would want to write. And everybody said, you got to read this blog. So you were actually one of the early examples of blogs I ever remember teaching students when I taught them blogging. Yeah.
How exciting. I really miss blogging. I've been, you know, since writing the book, and just generally, I think things have changed so much in terms of blogging platforms, but it's something that I keep intending to return to on a more regular basis, because it's, I think it was a really powerful way of creating community and just sharing knowledge and conversation on a kind of like almost this, the spontaneity of blogs, I think, was something that was really powerful. And actually, it's kind of a loss to public discourse, I think, that we don't have so much of that anymore. Things are far more curated these days and, you know,
yeah,
edited.
I have sort of been bummed out by the shift to the newsletter. Like, that's the new thing. Everyone has a newsletter. And I get it. And in some ways, I appreciate it. But also, I do miss the days of just stumbling on this treasure trove of people's often medium edited thoughts. So you got a little bit more, I think, like texture out of blogs in a way.
Yes. And I think it's also, there's something going on where like everything is about sharing just with, you know, a select kind of exclusive community. And that definitely has its benefits, as you said. But I also think that there's something commodified about it. So, you know, even with stories on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, like it's all, and newsletters as well, it's all very much about, you're part of my exclusive group. And of course, that then leads to eventually you can charge that exclusive group for content. And there was something about blogs that was just, you know, it's kind of open knowledge and just sharing with everyone or anyone who happens to see your site. So yeah, that's great to hear that my blog reached you as well. And yeah, it very much was, I mean, it was such a kind of life-changing thing for me to start that blog, really. Even though I did it as, you know, related to what we were just saying, it wasn't something that I spent a lot of time deliberating on. It was very spontaneous. I discovered blogs, and next thing I know, I'd kind of set one up. But you know, the more I kind of entered the character of Ms. Afropolitan, almost, the more, you know, that kind of became my life and my lifestyle, and this kind of continuing and deepening path into living a feminist life, really. So it's something that I'm, you know, I'm kind of very grateful that technology appeared.
Well, and it's a good foray into sort of the central focus of sensuous knowledge, which is this idea of sensuous knowledge. And what is it? And why do you advocate for it? And I don't want to say what it's not, because I don't think I want, like the whole point is not to binarize. So I don't want to re-binarize. But certainly, like, what kinds of things is it trying to disrupt or displace? And do you want to talk a little bit about how you conceptualize sensuous knowledge and what its relationship to feminism is, and how, as you mentioned, it sort of works to at least attempt to decenter Euro-patriarchal conceptualizations of knowledge and value?
Absolutely. So the two main concepts in the book, like the kind of conceptualizations or theorizations, are what I refer to as sensuous knowledge and then what I refer to as Euro-patriarchal knowledge. And throughout the book, I kind of contrast these two. So I'll explain what each of them are to give listeners an idea of what they mean. So sensuous knowledge, firstly, which is, and most importantly, because that is the conceptualization that the book is titled after, of course, and but also the kind of utopian Black feminist view that I have almost. Although I would like to, I'd follow immediately by saying that it's a kind of, I see it as being a pragmatic utopian vision. I really do think that it's something that can be practiced as well as theorized. So sensuous knowledge is it's an approach to epistemology that is holistic and embodied and spiritual, in that it aims to interweave two fields that are typically separated, which we can call the political and the aesthetic, if you like. There's many ways that this has been, you know, this kind of bifurcation has been referred to in the past. So, you know, it could be the mind, body, spirit split, or intellect versus feeling, art versus science. But I tend to think of it as the political, which includes topics and realms that we typically see as deserving of gravitas. So science and analysis and rational thinking, technology, economy, those kinds of things. And then the aesthetic, which we conventionally would include, in which we would conventionally include the arts, the body, the spiritual, the non-human natural world, poetry, and things like that. And conventionally, we have a split between these two. And the reason for this division between the political and the aesthetic is where what I refer to as Euro-patriarchal knowledge comes in, which is the epistemic realm that has sort of created this division. But importantly, it has created this division not simply to create taxonomies and classifications, which is part of its aim, but to create those taxonomies in order to control and to position its world prism as the kind of authority that then creates hierarchies of control, violence, and destruction. And so sensuous knowledge, in contrast, is kind of premised then on, because so one of the kind of underlying motivation, or maybe even a motto of mine in life and in my work, is that, you know, we cannot undo patriarchy or white supremacy or any type of class oppression or any oppression at all with the kind of by using a patriarchal logic. And so it's very similar to Audre Lorde's famous, "The master's house will not dismantle the master's tools will not dismantle the master's house." And so it kind of follows that if you're a patriarchal knowledge is an epistemology that is dividing between the political and the aesthetic, then sensuous knowledge is, by contrast, an epistemology that is connecting them, synthesizing and bringing them into conversation. And so it's sensuous knowledge is an approach to knowledge, to ways of knowing that brings the political and the aesthetic into conversation. And I start the book with connecting sensuous knowledge to Yoruba metaphysics. So I am, by by heritage Nigerian and Finnish, and I'm in Nigeria. My heritage is Yoruba, which is one of the ethnic groups in Nigeria. And in many ways, sensuous knowledge is actually a Yoruba epistemology, even though I actually don't speak the language, but I you know, it's so much of the world that I grew up in and that I'm still very much involved with, both kind of emotionally and psychologically, as well as academically and in my profession. And so in Yoruba metaphysics, there's a concept called Ogbon, which means knowledge, basically. But it is, you know, there's a kind of mythology around Ogbon. So it is said that the ancient gods gave the people Ogbon, but they split Ogbon into two. So they had Ogbon Ori and Ogbon Inu. And Ogbon Ori literally means knowledge of the head, and Ogbon Inu means literally knowledge of the gut. So you could say, intellectual knowledge and emotional intelligence. Mm. And they split Ogbon into these two. And the myth goes that they gave that to the people because they knew that if you just had one type of knowledge, either Ogbon Inu or Ogbon Ori, you were only partly wise. And so sensuous knowledge is a kind of reflection of Ogbon. So it is constituted of the political and the aesthetic, as I put it earlier. But also in the book, I speak a lot about about interiority. So it's thinking about interiority as a way of knowing in a way that Euro-patriarchal knowledge doesn't allow it to be. So in the way that we are all sort of conventionally educated in systems and structures and patterns and social imaginaries that are dominated and shaped by Euro-patriarchal knowledge, there is a kind of fear of interiority. There's, it's not just that we separate feeling, interiority, the poetic, the spiritual. There's so many ways that we could call that, but there's actually a kind of fear of it. We kind of are allowed to acknowledge it, and we're even allowed to say that, perhaps it's beneficial to some extent, and it's certainly like beautiful and maybe entertaining, but it's not. We're afraid of it being actually kind of used in a pragmatic way as a methodology for transformation, for knowledge, for Bildung. So sensuous knowledge is kind of seeking to do all of these things. And it might be worth mentioning also that the kind of the difference between the word sensuous and sensual, very briefly. So sensuous was coined by John Milton, and he was looking for a word to describe poetry, his genre, feel that sensual was right because it connotes the bodily pleasures. And he was looking for a word that could point to the kind of integration of the mind, body, and the soul. I think that's how he himself put it. And so he proposes the term sensuous. I like that sort of etymology of the word, even though it has since been used in very different ways. It was used by Karl Marx. I found after writing my book, actually, that he has a paper about something he also refers to as sensuous knowledge. So it's a word that is quite malleable and fluid. I don't mean to say that it has a kind of rigid definition, but I think John Milton's coinage of it speaks to that you could, the other way you could say sensuous knowledge is simply poetic knowledge. And that brings me to why it is a Black feminist approach. Let me see where I can start with this. So one of the things that I argue in the book is that Black feminism is, you know, and we all know this kind of, Black feminism is the school of thought in which there are intersectional approaches. I mean, today we literally call it intersectionality, but throughout the history of Black feminist thought, there has always been this insistence on the kind of multiple oppressions that Black women face. It's been called multiple jeopardy. A Nigerian theorist called Molara Ogundipe-Leslie, she calls it the mountains on my back, in one of her books where she kind of theorizes about that. You know, there's just been so much discussion around what we now call intersectionality. And this points to how Black feminist thought is kind of the only ideology. And I should say that, you know, I'm really referring to Black feminist thought because I think there's so much conversation in our times about Black feminism. And quite often when you say Black feminism, people think of it as, I'm not really sure, but I think people tend to think of Black feminism as like individual Black feminists and what they might be contributing, or a kind of feminism that is thinking about race. But when I say Black feminism, I'm thinking about a school of thought, like the actual, you know, ideas and arguments that are typical of Black feminism throughout a period of time, throughout its conception to today, basically. And so in Black feminism, I would say that the thought is a reflection of an ideology which is unique in its thinking about multiple oppressions and the intersections of those. So, you know, no other ideology really looks at things in this way. No other, I should not say ideology, rather a kind of resistance movement, resistance ideology, perhaps more specifically. So feminism has obviously like centered on patriarchy. So like, you know, the kind of mainstream popular feminism centers on patriarchy. Marxism centered on class structures. Black liberation has centered on race. So Black feminism as an ideology is unique in actually, you know, looking at all of these different structures of oppression. But in addition to that, Black feminism, and not only in addition, but also consequently, Black feminism has always been an ideology in which the poetic and the more than human world are of central relevance. So by nature of not being allowed to enter spaces where knowledge is formed, you know, education, leadership, the cultural world, Black women have had to kind of invent or carve out pockets of space in which they can create language and knowledge, and that has often been in the poetic realm. So sensuous knowledge is, even though it's a, you know, it's my kind of unique take, and you know, it's certainly not something that every Black feminist would not necessarily adopt that same approach, but it is, you know, in these ways that I've just described, the kind of intersectional, poetic, and in considering the natural world, sensuous knowledge, you know, fits into that compendium of resistance and ideological thought. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. I hadn't thought about this, but when you, right, I even think about when I teach, and I teach at a predominantly white institution, so it's not like I'm drawing from a wealth of options. But when you say like what what is Black feminist thought, people will name individual Black feminists who have thoughts, not a body of thought. I mean, and obviously that's not true. It's just, I think that is right. I think that's the perception. You might get like an Audre Lorde or a Toni Morrison, but you don't really get a strong collective theory of an entire epistemology, as you say.
Yeah, and that really bothers me a lot. You know, it's I think it's so indicative of how marginalized Black women actually are, and how unseriously, you know, our kind of body of work as Black feminists is taken, and sometimes even, you know, by Black women ourselves. Like, there's I think, you know, when you think about in our times, you know, there's a lot of Black feminism that you could argue is aligned with neoliberal perspectives and worldviews, and you know, that's okay, because Black feminist thought can have there can be like intra ideological conversations, if you like. But I think, you know, for instance, if we think about somebody like Beyoncé, she's such an easy example, and I feel like I'm being a bit lazy by using her, but I will nevertheless, because it kind of makes it easier to explain.
We'll call it accessible.
It's accessible, yeah. But you know, she's somebody who's probably like, you know, she's definitely aligned in many ways with the kind of neoliberal spirit of our times, and capitalism and things like that. But she also, in many ways, is aligned with, you know, the kind of traditional Black feminist school of thought. Mm. But it's until we kind of are able to see that there is a trajectory and a compendium of Black feminist thought, a lot of the conversations around whether or not Beyoncé is contributing progressively to feminism or not, and that kind of discussion, it just isn't very productive, or it isn't as productive as it could be. Because I think if we look at like what Black feminist thought traditionally is, which is, again, not to say that it can't be something else, there's always, you know, people can dispute that, but what it traditionally has represented is, you know, is this, especially this intersection between gender, race, and class, and also, very importantly, anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism. Black feminism has really been a kind of repository for, and I mean that in not in a negative sense, as like a place where we dump, you know, every single oppression, but actually something that has really enriched, what makes it such a rich space is that it has considered all of these things combined. And so when we think of it that way, then, you know, and we then look at the work and the art of somebody like Beyoncé, I think it just opens up a space for, you know, far more complex conversations than if we just think of Black feminism as individuals.
Well, and I think Beyoncé is a good example for a couple of reasons, and obviously, which is interesting because Beyoncé is sort of like she's like your grab example throughout the book. I think you mentioned her three or four times, even though she doesn't get any sustained treatment, which I actually appreciated, because I've read a lot of Black feminist thought that uses a lot of Beyoncé, and it was nice to see you using so many examples, some of which I was familiar with, but I was seeing in new ways, like Lauryn Hill, and some of which I was not familiar with, like the Singularity University example. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I think one of the things that Beyoncé helps to illustrate that you bring up throughout the book is that you really want to center, I'm probably going to say this like wrong, but you really want to center joy as part of the conversation about, like joy has to be a huge part of Black feminist thought and what it means to have sensuous knowledge, because so often, right, like Black women are thought of as just like oppressed. And so everything's lack and everything's gloom. And so it's not that those things aren't there. And obviously there are some parts of this book that, I mean, really almost took my breath away. They were so upsetting, and many of them were very personal to you, but there was also a lot of joy and like stickiness is a word that Shayla Lawson uses. And I thought about it as I was reading the book, that there are just these interesting moments of complex stickiness that are at once joyful and interesting, but also, I mean, clearly, like, there was a lot of suffering happening. And so Beyoncé is good because, I mean, I think one thing she does well is that's always all on the forefront. And she doesn't really trade one for the other. She brings it all into the music or the music video or the interview or the performance.
Yeah, I love that. And I love this phrase complex stickiness. Absolutely. I think she, I've written a few times about Beyoncé on my blog, and I've kind of swayed between writing, you know, like I had a blog post that was called In Praise of Beyoncé, and then I've been more critical about her as well, probably on social media rather than on my blog. But in the book, I think I wanted to, like, wherever I do mention her, it's, you know, it's reflecting of her complexity, I guess, and of the complexity of us all, therefore. Like, she's definitely, there's things about the kind of the conversation that she puts out into civic space through her art, and the way that kind of clashes with kind of conventional Black feminist thought. Joy is something that she certainly foregrounds in her work, which I appreciate a lot. And yes, as you said, absolutely right. It's joy is really central to sensuous knowledge. There's been a lot of conversation about black sort of hashtag Black joy, which I think is mainly positive, but one of the things that can go lost and that is essential to me in the book is that it is a kind of political joy. I think I describe it as a joy that is kind of a mix. Political joy is a kind of mix of rage and hope, I think I say. So it's the feeling of it is almost as if you'd like survived a near death experience, and you're then like committed to living in a way that is joyous insofar that it is intentional almost, it is meaningful, it is striving to be intentional and meaningful. This is, of course, a process for me, as it is for most of us. But it is, I mean, maybe, I think it also has a lot to do with desire and the kind of the gap between our desires in patriarchal society and like how unfulfilled they often are. I tend to think that we're all driven by at least three desires. One is the kind of the desire to have meaningful connections with others. So a kind of desire for love, whether it's romantic or platonic or erotic. And then there's a desire that we all typically feel, which is a desire for social progress and subsequently social change toward that progress, even if we all kind of envision progress differently. And then the third desire that I think people have is the thirst for knowledge. So certainly these three desires feel like, you know, they're kind of lodestars in my life. And I think I would say that they also are lodestars for the kind of obstacles that I face in my life that are both, you know, whether they are personal or political obstacles. It is the political obstacles that we call institutionalized oppression. And you know, the kind of the more that we are striving toward fulfilling these desires, we simultaneously become more aware of the obstacles for them, as well as the opportunities. But that kind of triangular ecology of desire and obstacle is the space in which I think political joy emerges. You know, because when you do sort of, if you transcend an obstacle, or even if you just are part of a community, because, you know, the reality is that if you look back at Black liberation, class struggle, feminist movements, you know, they are not obstacles that are transcended in a lifetime. This has been going on for centuries. Right. But just being, just seeing, you know, small steps or in an individual life, it can be a big change that manifests. And that is, that can be a space of political joy. And it's also a space which, you know, it's such a kind of a raison d'etre for writing and thinking about sensuous knowledge in the way that I do, because in order to move beyond, you know, the here, this kind of oppressive here in which we have to exist, we have to move beyond into different dimensions and imaginaries in a whole way. And so if we are trying to move beyond with Euro-patriarchal knowledge, we create yet an obstacle. So sensuous knowledge is an attempt to provide a tool, one tool in you know, in the kind of conceptual what's the word I'm thinking of? I have a good word on the tip of my tongue, but can't remember it. But a kind of the lexicon of feminist.
Yeah, I was going to say arsenal, but then I was like, no, that's military. Let's not go there. But your toolkit, right? I know what you're saying, though. Your resources, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I had something similar. I think it was also like had a military connotation.
I keep trying to back down from those, but they're everywhere. I hadn't realized it till I started trying not to use them anymore.
Yeah, but yes, it's one lexical tool with which to, and not just lexical, actually, one kind of, it's also, it's more active, I think, than just being a linguistic one, with which to really, like, explode that space that keeps preventing us from progress.
Yeah, well, they're kind of like, I don't know, like attitudinal, because I know what you mean. They are lexical in the sense that they are like they're words that live in language, but they're concept metaphors that are meant to, and I found myself thinking about this as I read through the book. They're trying to like push on how you think the world works or what you think is possible. So to me, it felt like, yeah, it was words doing it, but it was connecting with my psyche and sort of this like attitudinal shift or this outlook shift. So I know what you mean there. It is more, the sensuous knowledge is a lot more active than just a lexicon, even though it is also a lexicon. I see where what you're trying to get at there.
Yeah, and I really appreciate what you just said. I remember actually once, I think it was Linda Gregg, the poet, but I might be wrong. I think she was the one who said she defined, or she was encouraging the attitude of poetry. And I just really love that, and I think I thought this is what sensuous knowledge also is doing, among other things. But it's like it's so attitudinal. I really like that. It's definitely and I've also come across the term psychoactive, which is
psychoactive is good. Yeah,
yeah. So it's really trying to my book wants to shift something in the interiority of the reader, in how they perceive the world, without saying that this is how you should perceive it, but, you know, just to kind of query and challenge the ways that we are asked to think, not only by your patriarchal knowledge, but I think, you know, in these days, there's just so many manifestations of Euro-patriarchal knowledge, you know, like surveillance capitalism, a lot of social media activism, which borrows from this like a kind of robotic, the machine-like way of communicating that is devoid of feeling and dialogue that Euro-patriarchal knowledge has championed.
Yeah. And you give so many different, I don't want to call them examples necessarily, because each one sort of does something different with the concept, but you give different manifestations or sort of like concretizations of sensuous knowledge. And they range from rivers as a reconceptualization of how you conceive of power under a sensuous knowledge framework to people like Lauryn Hill. So just because for the sake of time, is there one in particular that you really think, even the color indigo, which was a beautiful meditation on just what this one color can do to disrupt these like Western logics of girls are pink and boys, you know, like indigo is this almost third term. Do you have one in particular that you really resonate with or that you think is a good illustration for someone who hasn't read the book and wants to grasp a little more about sensuous knowledge?
Yeah, I think I'll go with exusions, which was because I've written some follow-up essays. I'm still writing. It's a series where I'm developing exusions on a platform called Perspectiva. So, you know, if I speak about it and somebody wants to sort of read more than what is in the book, that exists. So exusions is a concept that I coin in my chapter about power and sensuous knowledge. It comes from the ancient Greek word exousia, which means power. And it is based on conversations that I had with rivers, which, you know, sounds a little bit out there. But I felt a really strong need to literally sort of try to have a conversation with rivers. And so I would, you know, go to rivers or just sort of I'd spend days, if not weeks, just watching videos of rivers and like sometimes, you know, slowing them down and pausing and just trying to talk. And this for me was, it was somehow obsessive. And I think it had to do partly with that I was grieving. I was exploring sensuous knowledge. There was, you know, a lot of sort of internal motivations for that I can't even yet fully explain. But what emerged was that rivers spoke to me about power. And power, the exploration of power, has been something that has preoccupied me for, you know, over a decade. I did my master's thesis, was about power. And just really the sense of what I was saying earlier, that like, you know, patriarchal logic cannot help us to envision new worlds. And so much about, like in the work that I've done, traveling around the world, doing advocacy work and connecting with, you know, amazing grassroots organizations and activists and artists around the world. I just had this, I've had this kind of nagging sense that so much of why we are not making as much progress as we want to, even though we are making a lot of progress, has to do with that we still understand power, the same power structures that we're trying to erode. We still understand them. We still understand our own movements with that same, not just language, as you pointed to earlier, it's not just lexical, but with this, the same kind of images in our psyches, the symbolisms of power as something that is synonymous with authority, with violence, with coercion. And so rivers started to provide me with new images of power. And from that, I kind of, so what I saw was the way that, you know, when a river meets an obstacle, it will move its way above or under or around or through the obstacle until it, you know, reaches its destination, which is the ocean. And along this way, there's all these tributaries and streams that join it. And so the language that emerged was something that I called branching, which, you know, the river's branches, which are these tributaries and streams, etc. And the way in which you know, it's kind of like the chicken or egg scenario where you can't really tell if the branches are what are feeding the river, if the river is feeding the branches. But nevertheless, everything is just moving toward this kind of final destination. So I then developed that. And in the chapter, I look particularly at the river Yangtze, the Thames River, and the Niger River. And I go on this journey on some of the kind of history and the mythology and the political socio-political events that have occurred along these three rivers, and just explore power through this language that I'm exploring. Exusions is an example of sensuous knowledge as it manifests when thinking about universal concepts like power.
Well, and I especially appreciated this example because one of the things I do sort of as a living and as a hobby is just point out cliches. It's like my favorite thing to do ever. So I love when people tear apart a cliche that I think is particularly destructive. And one of the things that you'll, I don't know if you noticed this, but I hear it a lot, or I'll see it in motivational books or sports psychology, things like that, about Bruce Lee and this quote about being like a river and about flowing and not letting things get in your way. And I was always like, I mean, I guess I don't know who can live like this. And also, have you met a river? Because I like rivers do all kinds of stuff, and they also often are very aggressive. And yeah, sometimes they're dried up because of capitalist exploitation. And it's just like the quote has just, see, people keep recirculating it. And I'm like, I'm glad it worked for Bruce Lee, but it's not good. It just as motivational fodder, it's really empty and unprivileged and just kind of like out of touch with the reality of most people and nature and what's happening in the global climate crisis. And so this chapter was really awesome for the way that it reconceptualized the relationship between river and power and privilege in a lot of ways that I thought was just so much more rich in understanding than kind of how rivers get exploited as metaphors, I think, for mundane ways of thinking about power flows.
Thank you. I haven't heard that quote, but I instantly can kind of glean how it could easily become a cliche. I mean, I've obviously encountered many other sort of cliched metaphors about rivers, and they so easily lend themselves to the poetic. And I use that too, but I also, I was mindful for one of like not wanting to anthropomorphize rivers too much. You know, but also to afford or just kind of show that rivers are complex. Saying afford them complexity is instantly doing what I said I don't want to do, which is anthropomorphizing.
Well, we do what we can, you know. We do the best we can.
It's so tricky, but you know, just kind of, I think, seeing that, yeah, rivers are not just like this beautiful poetic imagery. They also are responsible for, because of capitalist exploitation and climate change and things like that. But they, even prior to that, they, you know, they're also can be responsible for the deaths of millions of people throughout the course of human history. And so it's just, I guess what really lies at the root of it is just expanding language and symbols and being able to be part of an ecology in the way that Euro-patriarchal knowledge limits us and, you know, creates again these kind of robotic hierarchies between humans and other parts of nature, because of course we're very much part of nature, or we are nature. And so, you know, it's the beginnings of a lifelong attempt and relationship for me to really just be in communication with the ecology in which I exist.
Yeah, you had this great quote. I don't know if it's a quote, but it's a little anecdote in the book about a painter, and I can't remember their name, but I think they're like a European white male painter who says that a painter should not paint like a nature scene if they cannot imagine themselves as part of the scene. And if they cannot imagine themselves as part of the scene, then maybe they shouldn't be painting. And I just thought that was so illustrative of this argument. And I mean, not to put your words in somebody else's words. I'm just bringing up an illustration that you also brought up as a, another kind of touchstone for people listening who want maybe a little bit more grounding on some of these concepts?
I can't actually think of which quote that is.
It was a painting of, they were on a picnic and they were looking out over a valley, and like there'd even been a protest movement because the valley was going to, had erosion and nobody was going to take care of it. But because of its role in art and history, the people got together and they protected the valley. And the painting is of these two people on a picnic, him and his woman, I think, his wife or something.
Yeah. What's his name?
I know. I'm bad with names. You have such a wealth of knowledge in this book, and I couldn't hold on to a third of it in my memory.
I mean, even I can't clearly, but it's called Friedrich something.
Yes, it's a Friedrich. Yes, that's
yeah.
right. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think what I'm saying about him is that because he was part of the Romantic movement. So one of the things that I point out in the book is that Europatriarchal knowledge is, you know, I very intentionally am calling it knowledge rather than just say Europatriarchy, because it's looking precisely at the epistemic contribution of Europatriarchal knowledge. And I distinguish that kind of from Europatriarchal structures, say, because Europatriarchal structures have never like contributed with anything progressive. You know, it's all pretty destructive in terms of the systems and the structures of capitalism, of patriarchy, all of that. But Europatriarchal knowledge is not all negative, actually, necessarily. So Europatriarchal knowledge has, you know, this obsession with the kind of mechanic and the robotic and classification and things like that has, you know, led to many scientific breakthroughs, to the invention of modern universities and encyclopedias. And, you know, it's kind of the Enlightenment is part of it as well. One of the kind of branches of Europatriarchal knowledge that has been a kind of internal critique of it is the Romantic movement. And Friedrich, this painter, was part of that movement. You know, they were predominantly men who were calling for a more like emotional approach to knowledge. So I basically say in the book that sensuous knowledge is, you know, it's kind of has similarities with the Romantics. But at the same time that, you know, they were so biased and blind to their own kind of racism and classism and sexism, so it, you know, it kind of makes a lot of their thinking untrue but yes, that there's also, you know, there can be value that comes out of it, and part of sensuous knowledge and it being such a kind of a big motivation for it being such a hybrid is precisely so that we can take what is useful. You know, it's not out of knowledge that exists, whether it is indigenous or Europatriarchal or whichever contribution to knowledge that has been made throughout the course of history by humans and non-humans, can be utilized if it is useful for getting us to that sort of next higher dimension that we need to move toward. It's just that for the most part, Europatriarchal knowledge doesn't do that. But we have, because it's so centered on creating domination and hierarchy. But, you know, in order to really both critique it and to hopefully eventually reduce its dominance in the world, we have to really understand it, understand what motivates it, but also afford it a kind of, you know, sometimes a usefulness and a value.
Yeah. And it's a generous, I mean, I would say it's a generous book on that front, which is, I know, is always a hard thing for, I interview so many authors on this podcast and they all have such different approaches and some choose to be generous. And you, I thought, reflected nicely throughout the book on why that might be an option for you, but you could understand why it might not be an option for other people, like that, that woman who approached you at, you were speaking at a conference, I believe, and she was a Black British woman. And she said, I'm done having these conversations with white people, when you had said that, and it's because of your different histories and positions and where you grew up because you didn't grow up in Britain. And it was a very generous approach. And I mean, I thought I liked it because it didn't take away from the book in terms of it didn't feel like you were trying to be artificially inclusive just for the sake of like writing a book that, you know, wouldn't ruffle any feathers. It just felt fair. It felt fair. And, you know, you were willing to give credit where credit was due and also to refuse to give credit in many other places. Like I thought the Singularity a University example was really important because you go to this sort of some of the most advanced thinkers in the world go to this Singularity University to study and to lecture and to teach. And you show up and you're talking to these people who have all the potential to kind of bring this sensuous knowledge into being, right? They have the money and the resources and here they are talking about how they're just going to like get theirs and make sure that they live until they're 150 without any thought of how impossible that is for 99%. And it's a really testament to the way you traverse the good and the bad throughout the book and acknowledge that we have potential to do these things. It's just, right, these structures so rarely produce the outcome that would align with Black feminist values. That's not to say that they never do it.
Thank you so much, Lee. Thanks for like such a close reading of the book and understanding some of its intentions. Absolutely. I think it goes back to where I started and saying that it has. It's a book that I would in some ways call a pragmatic utopia or pragmatic utopian vision. And, you know, I think that part of the pragmatic part is that, you know, we are all quite invested in what I'm referring to as Euro-patriarchal knowledge. It's very difficult to not be part of that way of thinking, the understanding of it is the very sort of beginning of the journey to undo it. And I think so often when in a lot of, radical thought, the vilification, the sort of blanket condemnation and vilification makes it difficult to really understand and grapple and maybe see how we are complicit. And therefore, it doesn't always convince me that we can undo it because it just becomes this like bogeyman. It's almost very religious. It's like God and Satan. And like there's a lot of that kind of approach in the zeitgeist. And for me, like a pragmatic utopia it's not about, as you said, like I'm not interested in kind of assuaging or, including for the sake of including. I'm just deeply sort of aware of my own realities and the larger goals that I would really wish in terms of going back to desire and the kind of the social progress that I want. And I think, taking a pragmatic approach to that is what seems the kind of most realistic to me. And so a sensuous knowledge is very much centered around that kind of thought.
Well, I so appreciate the work. I appreciate the energy it must have taken to write so accessibly through such dense ideas, the research, even the audiobook narrator that you, I assume, had a hand in selecting was fabulous. Yeah. First I read the book and then I wanted to listen to it again and I was traveling, so I got the audiobook. And I will say it's just as pleasant in both formats, which is a hard nut to crack.
Robin Miles. Yeah.
So for anyone listening, I cannot recommend the book enough. Yep. You can, if you're listening right now on your phone or on your web or on your desktop, go ahead and just open up the show notes and you'll see a link to bookshop.org and to the HarperCollins website where you can head over and get a copy of the book. And I always like to remind people that this is the kind of book we really want everyone reading, especially women of color, especially young women of color. And with resources being what they are, they're not getting into libraries the way that they did. So if you aren't inclined to get a copy of your for yourself, don't hesitate to head into a library and donate a copy. They especially appreciate hard copies. Or you can put in a request to have them purchase one, although that's might not be in some budgets. But donating to libraries books like this is a really nice thing that you can do right now and to reward writers like Minna for their work. And with that, Minna, is there anything you want to say to the people and let us know what you're up to right now or new projects? Or are you just recovering and basking in the rewards of a job well done?
Thank you very much to everybody who's listened and made it to the end, if you have made it to the end. and, you know, thank you to Yuli. It's been such an honor to be on your wonderful show. I'm kind of gearing up for a lot of speaking about my book. So it's been locked down here in London, as it has for you as well, no doubt. So I haven't really, since the book came out, I haven't been able to do in-person events, and I've got quite a few of those coming up. So I'm really excited about that for the autumn.
Well, terrific. And I assume you have a website where you post public speaking engagements. Is that something that people could look up if they wanted to see you talk, or are these going to be pretty much things that are closed to the public?
No, they're mostly open to the public. I haven't been updating the page where I normally would share where upcoming events. So if anybody would love to join one of them, please get in touch with me. There's a contact form on my website, or you can just holler at me on Instagram or something.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening. Please definitely check out a copy of Sensuous Knowledge. And Minna, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's been great. Thank you so much.